pioneering organic farmer Elliot Coleman. 30 years ago, farmer Elliot Coleman sat down to write a book about his techniques for growing organic food. The book would spark a revolution. The new organic grower sold hundreds of thousands of copies and fueled the organic food movement. In the 3 decades since the book was published, Coleman has traveled the world, learning from other farmers, and has improved his own expertise through experimentation and innovation. He also continues to farm and operate a year-round market garden in Harborside, Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Elliot Coleman talks about his life's work and the organic movement. Have you been inspired by Coleman's life and work? Do you have questions for him about winter gardening, crop rotation, or hoes? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For many of us, when thinking about organic farming, one name comes to mind, Elliot Coleman. Elliot is a pioneer in the field of healthy, simple, sustainable farming. He joins me today to talk about the new edition, the 30th anniversary of his classic book, The New Organic Grower. Elliot Coleman, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm pleased to be here.
As always, we want to hear from you. Are you a backyard farmer? Do you seek out healthy homegrown food? What questions do you have for Elliot Coleman? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Elliot, especially appreciative today because I understand you're in the middle of a very busy week at your farm.
Yes, we are. It's a winter squash harvest, and we have a lot of it growing, and we need to get it into storage.
Take us back 30 years. Take us back to the time when you were first working on this book, and especially for our younger listeners who take all of this access to organic food for granted today. What was the reaction to your philosophy 30 years ago?
Well, even better to go back 50 years to 1968 when I first moved to Maine, and I first started farming on the land I'm on now. And basically, the conventional agricultural minds were horrified that these people with no scientific credentials were suggesting that there was a way to do it, a better way, not the way they were doing it. And you can understand that because if you understand the way the academic world works, the academics are used to being challenged by other academics. But they were being challenged by a bunch of people without academic degrees in agriculture. And they used to treat us as if we were some sort of half-wits, Luddites, people who knew nothing at all about what they were talking about. And so there was an attitude at the time that wasn't exactly friendly. But in time, what people noticed was that the buying public was responding incredibly positively to the fantastically tasty and beautiful food that the organic farmers were growing. And that was the start of the new world.
How did you know? As you said, you didn't have scientific training. You didn't grow up on a farm, did you?
No, I didn't. What got me into the game was I read a book about small farming, and it made it sound like an adventure. And I was an adventurer, so I decided I would go chase down that adventure. But having been an adventurer who spent a lot of time in the natural world climbing mountains and running rivers, I was aware that the natural world is an elegantly designed, really beautifully put together piece of work. And once I started thinking about it in terms of agriculture and growing food, it seemed quite logical that if there were more natural ways of doing it, they made a lot of sense.
Did you have any sense that you were sparking a revolution?
Well, the revolution actually had probably begun back in 1890, interestingly enough. That was when the first sort of health food types in Europe began reacting to what they were seeing in the food that was being produced. This was the start of the use of chemical fertilizers, especially chemical nitrogen fertilizer. And the principal pesticide back there was something called lead arsenide. Now, putting lead and arsenic on people's food, so it didn't take these people long to think something was wrong with what they were being offered. And the whole movement began then and slowly picked up steam. And I have an old book from Germany written in 1911, and it's entitled Soil Fertility, Crop Growth, and Human Health. So it wasn't long before the connection was being made.
Your philosophy isn't just about organic farming, though that's what your name is often associated with, but you're also a really big advocate for small-scale agriculture. And you believe that small farms can be successful, can bring in enough money for people to make it.
The quality of what the customer gets from the small local farm is what makes it such a popular idea. If the food is coming from far away, California, Florida, or whatever, it can be a week old by the time it reaches your refrigerator. But if you're near a small local farmers market supplied by local farmers, I know in the case of the markets we go to, the food that we are selling was harvested the day before, and that's about the definition of fresh. And if you investigate what happens to food when it sits around for a week, it can lose up to 40, 50, 60% of its nutritional value. So to eat the best food, you want to have local small farmers and buy it directly from them.
How has the book changed in 30 years? You didn't just republish it. You've gone back and edited and revised and added.
Yes, it came out in 1988, and I did a revision in 95. And whenever you write a book, you're instantly aware of all the things you wish you'd said something about. So I tried to put that together in 95. But the science of organic farming keeps developing. New ideas come in. And so it seemed like it was a good idea to bring it further up to date to the fully into the 21st century. And so I put in a lot of information on the history of the movement because I thought that was fascinating to find out that we weren't a bunch of Luddites back then, but that there was a whole history of interest in it. Then I wrote a whole nother chapter about the adventure of it and what is it about farming this way that is so compelling that hundreds and thousands of young people today are giving up normal jobs and wanting to get into becoming small-scale organic farmers.
Well, let's talk about those young people. I saw in an article about the James Beard Leadership Award that you won just a few years ago. In this article, you were referenced as a grandfather of the organic farming movement. I wanted to know your reaction to that category. And then also, is that how you feel about these people who are younger than 30 who are starting small farms?
Well, I suppose there were people back when I started in 65 to 68 who had the same attitude toward me, because there were well-established organic farmers in the U.S. At that time. And I think anybody who's in any field gets really excited to see a new young generation coming along that will take whatever the status of the science is at that point and move it on to a higher level of understanding.
Do you have young people coming to your door seeking wisdom on a regular basis?
I don't know, seeking wisdom, but we hire young people to work on our farm. And we also get some wonderful visitors. My book on the winter harvest has been translated into both French and German. And we get delightful visits from French and German students who were wandering around the U.S. On vacation and have read the book and want to come see the farm. And so sometimes they'll be there for lunch, and the conversation is usually in two or three languages and utterly fascinating.
So you mentioned your other book one of your other books about the winter harvest. And I wanted to ask you about this whole idea of winter farming. I've done a little reporting and what gave you the idea? When did you have the idea that, boy, I can farm in Maine year round without heat? Talk about somebody thinking an idea was a little bit kooky. I'm suspecting there were those who thought that.
Oh, my gosh. When we started, everybody thought it was utter lunacy. And for us, it was really like a trip to another planet because nobody had been there before. The original motivation was my dismay every fall at the end of the normal Maine growing season when I would basically give this little business I had created and cherished over to the Californians to supply food to my customers for the next 6 months. And so we just started working away at, gee, can we start a little earlier? Can we run a little later? And we started building greenhouses and other small structures and then larger greenhouses. And there sort of came the point with sort of this voila moment when we were going well into the fall and starting so early in the spring that the two overlapped. And then we had winter production. The idea of doing it without putting in heat came about just because it makes sense. I mean, if you give me a large heated greenhouse, I can become Maine's largest mango grower and probably be in Chapter 11 at the same time. But that's just a waste of resources. So the idea, could we provide fresh salads and other fresh crops to Mainers all during our long, cold winter without any resources other than just the simple sheet of plastic that we have on our pipe frame greenhouses? And it turned out we could, but the trick was to put a second layer of plastic inside the greenhouse about a foot above the soil. And the way it worked, and this we just stumbled over this and started playing with the idea, each layer of plastic moves the area underneath it about 500 miles to the south, climate-wise, here on the East Coast. So the first layer of plastic is the greenhouse itself. So outside, I'm in Maine. I walk into the greenhouse, and I'm suddenly in the climate of New Jersey. And then inside is that next layer of plastic, a foot above the ground. I reach my hand under there, and my hand is in Georgia. Well, there are plenty of hardy winter crops, and they can be spinach or scallions or carrots left in the ground or the wonderful Asian greens or kale or any of the crops that do not mind freezing weather. And they can then be successfully produced and sold all winter long, even in our climate.
I've never been to your farm, but I understand there is not a weed in sight. I understand it is a spectacularly beautiful and organized place, and that's part of your philosophy, isn't it?
Yes, we try and be professionals about what we do. I wish I could claim that there's never a weed in sight, but like any business, like any farm, there come times when there's too much to do for a couple of days and we get behind on the weed control. And if you get behind, it takes an enormous amount of work to get back on top of it. So the thing we always tell people is the secret is never to weed, always to cultivate. And by cultivate, I mean stirring the soil with a hoe when the weeds are no more than a quarter inch tall and they have no resistance and you can dispatch them easily. And then you keep this very tidy, neat-looking system. But not only does it look nice, it's so much easier to get the harvest work done when you're not battling through a six-foot-tall red root pigweed in order to get to your crop.
And to control those with hose, you're a big advocate of very straight rows and a lot of planting.
Yeah, it's just an efficiency thing. Let's say you're using a wheel hoe, which is a wonderful old tool that was used by vegetable growers back in the 18th century. You can be so much more efficient with it if you can go straight down the rows and then you can get closer to the crops and leave less space where there might be something to be hand weeded out. And the same with a hand hoe. And so we've designed hoes. We've designed them so they're comfortable to use in an upright position. And usually if you think of somebody with a hoe, they're bending over and they're chopping at the weeds in the ground. That is something that's going to tire you out very quickly. So we played around with redesigning hoes and the angle of the blade to the handle. And it turned out if you had a 70-degree angle, you could stand up holding the hoe with your thumbs pointing up the handle the same way it would be with a broom or a rake. And it turned out that when you thought about it, that was the ballroom dancing position, which people put themselves in voluntarily for fun. So the idea that you could be in a comfortable body position and getting the weeding done was one of the great successes in our redesigning of hose.
The 30th anniversary of your book is dedicated to Scott and Helen Nearing, with thanks to many of our listeners today. Those names, the names Scott and Helen Nearing, will be very meaningful. The reason that maybe a lot of you in the audience came to Maine, but to others, they might not know who we're talking about. Tell us about the Nearings and why you're thanking them in this book.
Well, they get thanked in this book because they sold me the land I'm on for a giveaway price because they thought that I looked like a promising young farmer and they wanted to help me out. The reason I originally came to Maine was to visit them after reading their book, Living the Good Life, which talked about making a living and surviving and feeding yourself well on a small farm. And that idea appealed to the adventurer in me. And they were doing it exceptionally well in Maine, as they had done it in Vermont. Scott was a well-known economist. He'd written about 50 books. Helen was a concert violinist and had traveled all around the world with her music passion. And they had decided that the most meaning for them in life was helping people figure out how to feed themselves. So they were actually independent of the system. And that's how they got into making it being done organically, because on the organic farm, if you do it right and you're making compost from all the waste materials in your backyard, that's the world's best fertilizer. You don't have to buy anything. And it also grows plants perfectly.
What is the operation of the farm like today? You said you're coming in from the squash harvest. How many people are there helping you? How much land are you cultivating?
Yeah, well, part of the reason the land they sold me was so inexpensive was it was all covered with spruce and fir trees and an awful lot of rocks and only had about 2 inches of topsoil, and it was a very acid topsoil at that. So it's taken quite a few years to get the stumps out, the trees cut down, and the rocks rolled to rock walls around the place, and also to put enough fertility into that initial poor soil that we could grow crops as well as we want to. The key to putting in fertility is just organic matter, whatever type of organic matter you find, whether it's the grass clippings that you just cut, or the hay on a neighbor's piece of land that they don't want, or any organic matter that can be broken down and returned to the soil that grew it in the first place in order to put life in the soil. Because people are always surprised when I tell them the best book I ever read about organic farming when I started was a textbook about soil microbiology, and written by a man from Rutgers named Selman Waxman. Soil microbiology is the study of all the little microorganisms in the soil. And it is their processes breaking down organic matter and bringing it back to the original minerals that makes everything work, makes food available to plants, and keeps the whole planet humming along nicely.
We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with organic garden and farming pioneer Elliot Coleman. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Maine General Health, offering services for every stage of a woman's life. Learn more at mainegeneral.org. Maine Public Television has a new public affairs program, the newly expanded Amon Porn Company, which is now an hour long and is broadcast each afternoon at 4:30. Journalist Christiane Amon Porn leads wide-ranging, in-depth conversations with global thought leaders and cultural influencers on the issues and trends impacting the world, from politics, business, and technology to arts, science, and sports. This program has just expanded and can also be seen at midnight, and it also airs at 4 a.m. and 12 noon on the Maine Public Television World Channel. The new season of Poldark on Masterpiece starts this coming Sunday evening on Maine Public Television, and we're holding just one more sneak preview advanced screening, which includes both the final episode of Season 3 and the new first episode of Season 4. The final public screening is at Bayside Bowl in Portland this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. Complete information is at mainepublic.org. Click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Elliot Coleman. He's the author of numerous books on farming, including Four Season Harvest and the Winter Harvest Handbook. His seminal book, The New Organic Grower, has a 30th anniversary, and it's coming out. It's been expanded and edited for this 30th anniversary. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You may send a brief, please brief, email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with Barbara, who's calling from Tamworth, New Hampshire. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on.
Hi. I'm just a small home farmer, gardener. But I'm a third-generation organic farmer, and like to do a lot of the things that Elliot has talked about in his books. My question is about the composition of compost and mulch. I am concerned, as someone who's always composted, about some of the things that your regular supermarket produce, leftovers, banana peels, that sort of thing. As far as whether they're actually doing a good thing for my garden and my compost pile or not. And also things that using for mulch. Recently I visited a friend in Cody, Wyoming, who's just in the last few years started a farmer's market there and is doing a lot with tunnels and enriching his soil to be organic. And he had an experience of getting a load of hay for mulch that ended up killing his crops because it had been treated with something, either as a mold preventer or herbicide or something. Not really sure what it was, but because I'd never heard of it. Anyway, I had a question about that, whether we should be concerned about what we're putting into our compost and what we're using for mulch.
Yeah, Barbara, you're right to be concerned, but it's pretty much the same thing as the food you buy for your family. It's really nice to know where it came from, who grew it, and how careful they were. And so it's the same with any materials you're going to bring into your garden. If you happen to have a farm field next door to your house, and therefore you know how it's been treated and there's waste hay from that, that's a great idea to get that and use it for mulch. And the materials you use for mulch, the organic materials, are also the same type of things that would go into your compost heap. But there are there is the possibility, and there have been a number of articles about it, of materials that are used in chemical agriculture that can have long-lasting problems. And so possibly the best and safest idea is, as much as possible, grow the organic matter for your garden right on your farm or your property by yourself. And if you can take an area the same size as your garden and grow clover on it for a year, and next year, after you turn under that clover, grow your garden there and put the other site into a soil-improving crop like clover. That's a great way to give the land a break from vegetables for a year, and during the year off, it's growing the fertility that you'll need next year.
Harper, thanks for your call. We have an email from Michael. We have a small vegetable garden and three raised planters. Our goal is to use no-till soil management. We've been top dressing the soil with compost each year, but if we add any more, it will overflow. Everything I've read about no-till recommends adding inches to feet of material on top each year. I can see this for a larger ground-level garden or a commercial farm. My question is, how do we ensure that the soil in our no-till raised planters gets enough nutrients every year?
Yes, a lot of the articles I see on no-till gardening I find very amusing because the author is saying, well, first, put down 4 inches of compost. And my reaction is, oh my gosh, if I had 4 inches of compost, I could garden in the driveway because that would be plenty enough to do what I need. And so you do not need to do that for no-till. You merely want to just make sure that you keep the soil alive with plenty of organic matter in it, a great deal of which can come from the roots of the crops you just grow. The stems, the leaves, and stuff will go to the compost, but the roots are in there, and that's adding a great deal of organic matter to the soil. One of the easiest ways to maintain a no-till garden, if you want to get rid of the plants that are growing there that you are not in favor of, such as weeds, is you either cover the ground with an opaque tarp for a month, month and a half, and all of a sudden everything under there has been killed off and you have a clean space to plant in again without having had to turn over the soil. But from the point of view of your raised beds, you are going to want to continue adding possibly a half inch of compost on there every year just in order to keep up the soil building process.
We'll go to Aaron, who's calling from Alton Bay, New Hampshire. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling with Elliot Coleman today.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for taking my call. And Elliot, I'd certainly appreciate the work that you've offered the organic farming community. I myself am a small-scale organic farmer here in the central part of the state of New Hampshire, and I've been doing it for about 6 years. And I will be the first to admit that I'm a terrible farmer. There's many more folks that I could reach out to immediately that are doing a far better job than I am, but I try it every year. The part that I'm not convinced on yet is the financial viability of this career. My wife is a teacher, and that is the only way that I get the bills paid. And what I'd like to find out or have you drill into a little bit more is what you've been able to find traveling around, because I know there's other people out there that are saying that it is a viable career, people like John Martin and others. But I right now, I mean, I don't know the stats, but I know that well over half of the farmers out there in this country, regardless of scale, are dependent on off-farm income. So I just wanted to hear your deeper notions about the viability of this thing that we do.
Well, yeah, you're correct about the off-farm income, but it isn't just the small-scale farmers. About 40% of the income for your average large production farmer in the U.S. is coming from government subsidies. So, and also, if they are typical farms, very often one member of the couple has a teaching job or some off-farm job. Why do people keep farming? Well, it's just probably one of the more appealing ways to try and make a living. And yes, you can make a decent living on the small farm, as many small growers are showing. It just requires organizing your systems the way any business would need to organize their systems if they want to make a living. And that means doing a lot of planning, keeping notes on what you do each year so you can use that as a background for saying, oh yes, when we tried that, it didn't work, but when we tried something else, it did. And pay very, very close attention to the quality of the compost that you're making, because that is the real key, and that's been the key ever since people first started writing books about organic farming, or even back into the 1600s. There's a wonderful set of poems by an old guy named Thomas Tusser, and one of them was an acre well compost is worth acres three. Thy barns at thy harvest shall declare it to thee. And so this whole idea of putting organic matter in order to get the soil up to a level where it will produce effectively and give you the level of production that you want in order to make a living, it may take time at the start. It certainly did from the way we started. But if you keep after it, and as I say, keep good notes, make sure you are well versed in all the techniques you need to know, I guarantee you it will come.
Aaron, good luck to you. We're going to go to Jesse calling from Sweden. Is this Sweden, Maine?
That's right.
Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Elliot. Thank you for taking my call, Jen. My question is sort of a zone-pushing question. Elliot, I hope I'm remembering this right, but I'd heard that you have a fig plant or plants in perhaps one of your greenhouses, and I would just like you to talk about that a little bit and perhaps the viability of growing figs in Maine.
Sure, Jesse. Yes, we planted two fig trees in a greenhouse at our old house, and we had a radiant heater in that greenhouse because that was when we were trying to learn exactly how low temperatures could go in the winter and not hurt the hardy crops that we wanted to keep growing, like spinach. And so because of that radiant heater that kept the temperature in that greenhouse for the most part above 32 degrees Fahrenheit at night, those two fig trees would give us both the early crop and the late crop. When we finished those experiments and therefore did not want to pay for the propane to run that heater anymore, we then wrapped those fig trees with used fabric, like the type of fabric, spun bonded fabric that people use to cover beds in the garden. We'd wrap them with that every fall. They were in a greenhouse, so they had a slightly better climate than out of doors. And we no longer got the early crop, but we did get the late crop every year. And if you're a fan, as we were, of fresh figs, it was actually worth doing. And we have often thought that there is another tree that we very much enjoy the fruit of, and this is the pawpaw, which is a native tree to upper Midwest. It has delightfully flavored fruits. It's very hardy, but the one difference is it doesn't get enough heat in the Maine summer. So we have fantasized about having a greenhouse that would move, and it would spend the winter protecting the fig trees, and then we would move it over in the summer to give extra heat to the pawpaw trees, and we would be eating doubly well.
Jesse, thanks for your call. We're talking about winter farming and some of the experiments that have worked, Elliot Coleman. Do you have any spectacular failures that you would like to share with the rest of us to make us feel a little better?
Well, anybody who has tried new ideas has spectacular failures, especially when we're trying to design new tools and we have some idea, what if we twisted this that way and bent that way? And I have a shop full of the most ridiculous-looking failures. But then again, the successes have been so delightful that they make up for all that. The one thing I will say that I have never seen anybody fail with is if they have a good source of horse manure. And if you have a neighbor with horses or can have a stable nearby or keep a horse yourself, do me a favor. Don't bed the horses on sawdust or wood shavings. Bed them on straw. And all through history, all your best vegetable growers, and back in the 1800s, they all were what we would call organic today, have always known that the best, most unfailing fertilizer for the soil for vegetable growing is well-composted horse manure bedded on straw. The combination of the two of them, you will never go wrong.
We have an email from Allison. Many people assume that certified organic means no spray, but there are some allowable chemical sprays that an organic farmer can use, and some of these are toxic to bees. Please talk about how organic growers can meet public expectations while keeping a viable operation going. What are the compromises that must be made?
Well, Allison, I hope they aren't compromises that have to be made. There are compromises that are made. We use no pesticides at all on our farm because we focus on how to create the optimal growing conditions for the crop that will allow the crop to have all its systems together and have its integrity intact. You might look at organic farming from two points of view, what I call deep organic farming and shallow organic farming. And shallow organic farming, the people farming that way are basically copying chemical farming, but with less harmful inputs. So they will be using some sort of organically based pesticide. And, you know, there are some, and they work reasonably well. But in the deep organic farming philosophy, you understand that plants have their immune system just like human beings do. And if you're taking care of the soil correctly, studies today have shown that all those wonderful bacteria in the soil, if you are treating the soil correctly, can induce resistance in the plants purely from their activities and their associations with the roots of the plants. So yes, there are some allowable organic pesticides. They are a better deal for the world than the truly toxic ones. Yes, they do harm other insects than the ones that you are trying to control, and bees would certainly be part of that. And so the aim of your good organic growers is to run a deep organic farm, and on that farm, none of those problems will exist.
Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about the importance of strength training, especially as you age. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy. NonprofitMaine.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com. And Penobscot Financial Advisors, promoting financial health and fitness through fiduciary advice and asset management. Online at financially.fit.
Dr. Naveed Khan was taking his first ride in an all-terrain vehicle when it flipped. He was hurt badly and medevaced to a Fort Worth hospital.
They took one look at it and said, that is one of the worst forearm injuries we've ever seen.
3 days later, the air ambulance company called and asked how he would like to pay his $57,000 bill. Why it costs so much. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, during our public affairs programming, it's the Commonwealth Club of California. The topic, national security and climate change. The speakers are Secretary Leon Panetta and Rear Admiral David Titley. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Elliot Coleman. He has more than 50 years of experience in all aspects of organic farming, and his groundbreaking book, The New Organic Grower, is now out in a special 30th anniversary edition. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Ken. In 2010, we built one of your rebar winter gardens and would take it down each summer and put it back each winter. We loved the results, but I've gotten tired of the setup and takedown, so we've expanded to 12 by 40 feet, and we built a bow frame shed that will be 12 by 20 and slide back and forth. It will be a winter garden on one end and a hothouse for tomatoes on the other end. It's amazing how well that rebar system worked. Thank you. So that's pretty cool. A retractable greenhouse within a greenhouse.
Also known as displaceable greenhouses or movable greenhouses. I've been a great fan of this idea since I first saw one on a Dutch vegetable operation back in the mid-70s, and it was a huge greenhouse. It was 40 feet wide, 120 feet long, and it was a glass house with a metal frame, but it sat on railroad wheels that rolled on railroad rails. And the day I arrived at this holding, there were a couple of Dutchmen behind each corner pushing it down the track to the next site. Now, the beauty of this is that you can start an early crop under that greenhouse, but then once it's established and the cold is no longer as intense, that crop would be safe out of doors. So you just push it to the next spot where you can build it and grow the next crop you want to put in under it. There are lots of ways of moving greenhouses. We have experimented with all of them, and Jennifer, you asked a bit ago about our great failures. Well, there have been a couple of those that have been pretty spectacular, too. There's a picture in one of my slideshows of one of our experimental greenhouses wrapped around the telephone pole next to our farm because we didn't anchor it well enough.
A little wind.
So, yeah. So, yeah, there's wind, and you have to think about all these things. But there's a whole section in this revised edition of the New Organic Grower about movable greenhouses. And, Ken, I'm glad you're happy with them. I am, too, and I think it's one of the more productive ideas I ever learned by visiting other farmers.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Harrison. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. So my wife and I recently took over a small farm in Harrison. We have like five or six goats that, you know, we take care of. There's a back pasture in our farm that we would really like to grow out with some grass that the goats graze on. But the problem is the soil is really, really sandy, and I don't know if it's like, I don't really know how to revitalize the soil, so I was wondering if you could give me some advice on that. Thank you.
Right, John. One of the great revitalizers of soil, and people have known this for a long time, are the grasses. And so just go out there and plant them. I would say a combination of orchard grass and timothy, and I'd probably throw in some dwarf white clover to have a little nitrogen being produced from the association between legumes and the soil bacteria. But the best way to take any piece of ground and slowly bring it up to a level where it will be productive is with grass. Grass is the great healer. Grass is the great creator of soils. And if you think about it, the magnificent soils of the Midwest of the United States were all built just by the grasses and the buffalo that grazed them.
All right, Bob. John, good luck to you. An email from, I believe this is Murata. Ask Elliot to talk about the many apprentices he and Barbara have coached over the years and tell him Murata says he is getting younger every day.
Yes, Wamorado was one of our favorite workers. She uses the word apprentice. On many farms, apprentices are people who want to learn and come and work for free. We've always insisted that we're running a business, so everybody on our farm is an employee and are paid a fair salary and get as many benefits as the small farm can afford to provide. Murata now has her own business, sending a wonderful food all around the state of Maine from an operation called Northern Girl up in Aroostook County. And yes, one of the delights that we have encountered over the years are the number of young people who are anxious to get into this game, anxious to learn how to do it, and are willing to come and work on a farm just for the experience. And so they do participate in our farm, and we just pay them with good food and thanks. But the main labor for our farm are professionals who we hire to work with me and my family. And as I said, Murata is one of the best apprentices we ever had, and I'm so glad she's gone on to a successful career.
We have an email from Mary. We have 8 chickens and 3 raised beds for vegetables. I was wondering, is chicken waste, such as shavings or hay, okay to compost for our garden crops? I think this leads into one of your favorite topics, doesn't it?
Well, it does. One of the things we're doing, Mary, on our farm is every year, half of our good vegetable land is sown as early as we can to a mixture of grasses and legumes. And then once our new young laying hens, or pullets, so the baby chicks get big enough, they're housed in little movable houses and they're out on those fields. The houses are moved around. They have a wire mesh floor, so the manure at night falls through and the chickens are safe from predators. And that combination of chickens grazing and fertilizing the land, plus the grasses and clovers, it gives us all the fertility we need when that field is plowed up the following year and is growing vegetables, and the land that had been growing vegetables the year before is now in grass legume grazed by chickens. So chicken manure is a wonderful additive. And from the point of view of getting better value out of the money you spent to feed the chickens to get the eggs, 75% of what goes into a chicken's mouth comes out its rear end and is deposited on the ground. So that's a pretty neat way to get double use out of the money you spent on chicken feed.
And you call this concept the self-fed farm.
Well, we do like the idea of the self-fed farm. And this is another point to talk about. So many people's concepts of organic farming are actually based on organic gardening. And organic gardening, people buy a lot of fertilizers, and whether it is soybean meal or bone meal or something like that, they're all naturally based. And if you have no other way to fertilize your garden soil, they will do a pretty good job. But there's no way on the organic farm that anyone farming commercially could afford to pay the cost of all of those inputs. And so what we work on a serious organic farm is coming up with a no-input system. So the inputs are basically a partnership between us and Mother Nature and the sun and the wind and photosynthesis and grasses and biological organisms in the soil that create the fertility from within the farm. And this system years ago was quite popular in Europe, and they called it alternate husbandry, because basically the fields alternate between gaining fertility when they're in grass with animals grazing on them and exploiting it the following year when you till it up and put it in production again. And it's the great way to try and make people understand that organic is a very well-thought-out system that is probably the only way to feed human beings in perpetuity, because you do not need inputs. All you need is to work in harmony with the bounty of the earth and its systems, and you can maintain fertility for years to come, and I guarantee you, if we do it that way, we will be fed well forever and ever.
We'll go to Richard, one of your neighbors calling from Harborside. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi there. Recently, I've read where insects have declined to 80% from their previous things. Over 50 years, have you noticed that at your farm? Or because of your practices, have the insects, both beneficial and not beneficial, been able to be sustained?
Well, ideally, if there is a balance in the natural world, Richard, and I believe there is, insects are there because there is a role for them. And the role for insects in agriculture has always been understood as deselecting the weak and the unfit. The same way wolves in nature can only capture and kill the unhealthy caribou or deer. And so that same balance has been shown to be going on in the natural world. So as far as insects being a problem for the farm, if you do right by the soil, you won't have them. As far as there being fewer insects around, I love insects. I think they're neat creatures. And who was it who once said that God must have had an inordinate fondness for beetles because he made so many of them? I believe 80% of the insects on the planet are all beetles. Well, they are there, and it's only the ones that cause trouble for the farmers and the crops. Are there more or less of them? Well, if someone is carelessly spraying poisons, I suspect there are less, but I hope that is a bad habit that will not continue any longer.
We'll move to an email from Barbara. Where does Elliot Coleman source his ballroom dancing hoe? I want to get one for my husband for his birthday. We live solar off the grid and have a big organic garden, so any time savers are appreciated, as there's always something to do.
Well, Barbara, the best source of tools for gardening and small farming in the state of Maine is the Johnny's Selected Seeds catalog. And Johnny's Selected Seeds is in Albion, Maine. And the hoe that I designed for them, the one I call my ballroom dancing hoe with the 70-degree blade angle, is called the collineal hoe because the edge of the blade is in line with, collineal with, the handle itself. And it's just a very accurate, easy-to-work-with hoe. They now, or will have soon as when the supplies arrive, a new hoe, which is called a wire hoe. They've had something called the wire weeder for a number of years, but the wire hoe is wonderful. It's just a ingeniously designed piece of very stiff wire in a triangular shape that is as effective at getting rid of small weeds as anything you will ever try. It's effortless, and I think it's going to, in time, totally make people almost look forward to weeding.
We have an email from Demetra. My husband and I have raised garden beds, some about 16 inches deep, a couple double that size in depth. We live in town, Portland. We grow potatoes in the deeper beds. We grew potatoes in the deeper beds this summer and would like to grow them over the winter. Is this possible? Are there other root vegetables we'd be able to grow? Do we have to cover the beds with anything once we plant?
Yes, if you want to harvest over the winter, Demetra, potatoes are probably not your best choice because they are frost sensitive. The cold weather will kill them. And so that's definitely a summer crop. But one crop that we do grow and would thrive in the beds you have are carrots that we leave in the ground and harvest during the winter by putting a single layer of plastic or two, if you want to be absolutely sure, over the beds. And this can be something as simple as just some bowed saplings with a piece of plastic over them. The carrots that work this well the best, it's a variety called Mokum, M-O-K-U-M. We plant them the 1st of August, which seems very late because it is. You're not trying to get them for summer harvest. You're trying to get them to be the perfect size for winter harvest, and they will be the tastiest carrots you ever ate.
Well, that's going to be our last question. I apologize to everybody that we were not able to get to, but I think I would advise you to look at Elliot's new book. Elliot Coleman's a new organic grower, is in its 30th year. He's gone through and added to the chapters and edited it for, to include some of the expertise that you have gathered over the last 30 years. So thank you for being here today. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier and George Thomas. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.